We came to the conclusion that the working group is not to meet its goals in finite time. Anyone who is interested may go to the public archives and scan through that particular mail. It is like a suggestion, but one of those you can't reject. Followed by the usual discussion. So this is, as a quick update, how far you can get when you do the presentation one day too early. So I would like to ask André to give his presentation. Oh, by the way, I probably should remind you that also this meeting is videotaped and surveyed and broadcast everywhere for your own...
Just
audio, okay, so you don't have to hide. But for any people asking questions, please go to the mic and state your name first. Thank you.
Good morning, everybody. This is a kind of regular update that we deliver this working group. And we usually do this in form of incremental updates. So this time I thought, why don't I just devote one slide and briefly give you an update what are the major milestones of K-Route since it became operational. And K-Route became operational in May 1997. When RIPNCC was selected as the operator of this RouteServ, and the RouteServ itself was located at Lynx, an excellent connected point. We run NSDA since February 2003, and this is apart from improved performance of the software, also increased diversity of software that is used in the RouteServ system in general. We start any costing since July 2003 when we put into production our hot standby node in Amsterdam. And we entered wider Anycost deployment in, this year with four local nodes deployed and more in the pipeline. And we're investigating deployment of nodes outside the RIPNCC region. Some of them are going to be so-called global nodes. So what's the current status? As I said, two global nodes are operational, one in London, one in Amsterdam, and they take most of the load. One of them, since August this year, is available via PV6. Four local nodes are deployed, and the main objective is to improve service for local ISP communities, and these nodes are deployed inside the RIPNCC region. And latest deployments are Qatar and Italy. And you can have a look at our website, kroutservice.org, to see global distribution of mirror instances and some additional information. So what are our future plans? Well, as I said, more nodes are in the pipeline, and for the next few months we plan to deploy quite a few of them. We're investigating deployment of nodes outside the RIPNCC region. An objective here is slightly different. It's basically improving resilience and performance of the global service that KRouteServ provides. And we plan to locate these nodes at, so to say, topologically equidistant places, though there are not so many places where you can put a node with excellent interconnectivity. It's the same management mode. The RIPNCC remains the operator of a mirror instance, though the funding model is different, because there are no distinguished beneficiaries for these global nodes. RIPNCC is prepared to bear most of the costs related to deployment of these nodes or entering long-term agreements with regards to possible sponsorship. We're looking for 3 to 5 locations in Asia and the Americas, and in Asia Pacific we do this in cooperation with APNIC. Well, this slide so shows cumulative load of all 6 nodes we have. Well, this gaps in statistics is just gaps in statistics. It doesn't mean that root wasn't operational at that time. Sorry about this. Well, as you see, with deployment of the second global node, it's tailed some traffic from London node, which is as expected. And they share the load of the global key root system. And here you can see introduction of a node in Frankfurt in Germany, which, well, it's not that obvious, but it didn't steal any traffic, well, as such, from the global nodes. I didn't have time to compare this to other trends of other root operators and root so in general, but I think the trend is similar. Well, the load is slowly growing up. And, well, a few slides just to give you more information and further references. This is useful references for more information about Russo in general. And this slide contains more specific information about key root. And that completes my presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Andre. Any questions?
Jim Reed, DNS Moda. One question I have is that if I understand correctly, the plans are you're thinking about deploying instances of the server in North America. Now, North America is already very well provisioned. It's perhaps grossly over-provisioned with root servers already. Why should K be set up? Sorry, why should you be setting up an instance of K in the North Americas?
Well, there are two reasons. One of them is, in case of DDoS attack, K may be attacked individually. And then it doesn't matter if North America is over-provisioned with other servers. Because if you want to protect K root system as such, we would like to load or share the load of this possible DDoS at different locations. And in this case, we would like to have our system be able to share global load.
Yeah, I understand all of that, but it still seems to me that it's rather strange that WebNCC is proposing to spend substantial amounts of money putting a root server into one part of the world that doesn't read another root server.
Well, as I said, we are still investigating this. We are not proposing this yet. But if a global node installation in North America can attract significant traffic and not really steal this traffic from other nodes, I think it's a good reason to do this.
Any other questions? No? Okay then. Thanks, Andre.
Thank you.
And next in line, I guess, is Johan with an update on iRoot.
This will probably be a slightly similar presentation from our side. iRoot is anycasting quite far and wide, as you're probably aware. We've added a number of sites since the last Write meeting in many different places. And because of that, we now have, I believe it's 17 operational sites in all. We have hardware in more places, but 7 sites that actually drive or attract live traffic because we announced the service prefix there. The full list is clearly somewhat slanted towards Europe, because that is where we started out, but we are spreading to the other parts of the world as well. It's also the case that although we initially aimed for 25 sites, and that is still a target for us, we are changing the funding model, and we'll talk more about that on the next slide. We are changing the funding model, and because of that, our own budget for this, which was based on the cost we would incur for deploying 25 sites, may be expanded with some additional resources from local sites who help share the costs for deployment in their region or at their site. Initially we tried to avoid this, and we paid for everything ourselves, and that very clearly set an upper bound on how many sites we could deploy. However, we do see that with that strategy, we had to turn sites down, because with a limited number of sites available for financial reasons, we simply had to aim for the high traffic locations, and we had to turn down corners of the net where, well, the traffic simply couldn't justify the expense to us for a full site. So this is changing, and we are deploying both sites that are being sponsored and helped sponsored by others, and we are also deploying a new type of site, which is we refer to it as a microsite, which is slightly less well provisioned because it sits in a corner. It's typically a site we don't connect to a major exchange, but rather in a very localized internet community, and all of this to bring the costs down. This seems to be interesting. We are having questions and proposals from several places around the net to actually do this. Another issue with deploying a large Anycast network is once you've done your design, and once you've done your homework on the operations and stats sides, there is one thing with Anycast that is quite a lot of work, and that's peering. Peering is probably, in our experience, most of the work in day-to-day operations, because the design stuff is already taken care of, and we know how to do that in a streamlined fashion. But peering is always starting anew for each new site, and every old site you have, this is a constant work, adding peers, removing peers, changes in who is connected to what ISP, etc. I'm not saying we were entirely surprised by this, but it's certainly a major drag on our resources. as it comes to peering models, there is popular terminology these days which divides Anycast sites into global nodes and local nodes. This is the terminology that F uses. It's also the terminology that K uses. And the assumption here is that the local nodes only serve a local community. They have no default route from anywhere. So only direct peers will see this node, and the prefix will not propagate beyond the direct peers. And the usual way of implementing this is through the so-called no export community tag. The other one is to have a global node. We don't set no export community tag, and not setting that in conjunction with getting a default route from some sort of transit provider will give that site global visibility. that would be a global node. We don't really do it that way. And I thought that might be worth pointing out, because all the routes always like to point at their differences, and this is actually something that we do different than the others. We don't divide our sites into local sites and global sites, but we rather do this division on a peer-by-peer basis. So for each site, we look at the various peers, and most of them will only be peering with us. They will not provide transit. It will only be local. In some cases, we set the no community export tag. Some other peers provide transit for us and provide global reachability and visibility to this site. Because of this, our traffic patterns are they are somewhat different, because we see global traffic at most of our sites. Not all of them, but at most of our sites, rather than to have all the global traffic aggregate in just a few spots. the reason we want to do this is primarily that we want to optimize for bandwidth utilization. And by optimizing for bandwidth utilization and having global route propagation in more places than just a few centrally located sites, we increase our availability to soak up DDoS traffic in multiple places. And that more or less concludes my presentation. Any questions?
Jim Reed, DNS Moda again. I remember, I think it was whenever Lehman gave a presentation the last time about what was happening with the iRoute server. There were some questions asked about if the information about the criteria you were using for the selection of sites and the requirements for the name server infrastructure that was needed could be published. And I think it was agreed that Lehman said this would be done. Has this information been made available, or could it be made available, and if so, when?
I don't really remember this. The requirements for a site, was that a question?
Yeah, I think it was meant in the context of if somebody was interested in actually hosting one of the Anycasting nodes, what sort of need they would have in terms of bandwidth and equipment and 24/7 support, all those kind of things.
Well, I think those requirements are actually changing, because when we had a fixed upper bound on the number of sites we had budgeted for, as I said, of course we aimed for high traffic locations with as much peering and bandwidth as possible, but those places are beginning to get rather well served these days, and there are still corners of the net that are not close to any such place, and as I said, given that we can find a financial understanding where they will help offset our costs, I see no problem with deploying in more remote corners of the net where the bandwidth available obviously would be lower. Today, because we are accepting financial help, I see this as much more of a negotiable item than it was 6 months ago. As regards online support and hands-on support locally, etc. Well, part of deploying a lot of sites is to be less dependent on any single site. If we just had five, I would have a much higher requirement of local staff being able to step in on rather short notice. Now we have 17. In a few months we will have 25. Next year perhaps we will have something more. And of those 25 plus sites, a fair number of them if we have any sort of problem, we can probably live with just turning that site off for a while.
Okay.
That will not hold true for all of them. There are major sites, obviously, where we require closer cooperation with the local site, and we already have that.
Okay. Thanks. Thank you.
Johan, one question from my side. Do you see any other limitations on the upper bound of a single root name server other than economic reasons, like a natural technical bound or something?
As in number of sites you can deploy?
Yeah.
I don't think any technical reasons will be determining factors here. I think it's clear that it will be financial or political or layer 9 and above reasons that determine this. That said, it's kind of clear that if you deploy a very high number of sites, it will eventually reach a point where the economics of scale would cause more, let's call it fluctuation in how the sites actually perform. Stuff will break, etc. And my guess is that if we do that, we could reach a point where we would see more flap in the routing system due to the scale of the operation. In the particular case of the root server prefix, that shouldn't be dampened out if people configure stuff correctly. Not everyone does configure stuff correctly, so it could be dampened out in some corner. I don't see this as a major problem, but that's more or less the only technical issue I can see with having a really, really large number of sites. I know there are projects like, for instance, PCH and Bill Woodcock, who are aiming for any cost on the scale of hundreds of sites announcing the same prefixes. I think that would work. It's mostly a question of finding the financial model that can carry this.
Okay, thank you. Anyone else? So then, thanks again, Johan.
You're welcome.
And next in line is Olaf, I guess, with an update on DC.
Okay. This is good. Johan was before me, so this is the update on the DC project. It's an ongoing project at the Ripe SDC. It's me, Henk Uiterwaal, and Daniel Kernberg who are involved. Many people probably have seen this slide before. I give this update regularly, either in the TechSec working group or in the DNS working group if the TechSec working group doesn't meet. DC stands for Deployment of Internet Security Infrastructure, and it's a project where we look at things that, if deployed, would make the Internet a safer place. One of the first things that we started looking at was DNSSEC, and essentially that has been the focus over the last few years. Our goal is early deployment on the reverse tree. We have 1.2 full-time equivalents of persons. That's being me and Daniel and Hank partly. And this is our report since RIPE 48. So what have we been doing? Well, we've been we had our feet in the standards development process. Been active as DNSX co-chair, which takes a lot of work, I'll assure you. And the good news is, what I said here is that the ITF last call has concluded. It's still in progress because it has extended. But the good thing is that although the last call has not been concluded on the DNSSEC BIS documents, there is a teleconference scheduled for, I think, the 27th or the 29th among the IASG, which is probably an indication for one of the last steps before the documents hit the RFC queue. there could still be pitfalls. It's only done when it's done, but this looks fairly promising. We might have the documents in the RFC queue before the end of the month. We've also been involved in work as document editors. There is a document that we've done in collaboration with Erin and Manning on inbound rollovers. One of the problems that DNSSEC deployment has is that you have many anchor points, and if you want to configure a validator, you have to maintain the public keys of all those different entry nodes in the secure tree. And all these different entry points, all those zone owners, may have their own way to maintain their key set, their own rollover policies, and their keys might change. And there must be a way for you as a zone owner, as a validator configurer, as the owner of a validator, to track those changes. And you would preferably like to do this in band. And there are some efforts within the ITF to look at this. There is a proposal by Mike St. John's, and this is the first documentation of the idea. This is a version zero. We're working at the version 01. And it's also addressing one of the problems that has to do with the introduction of the trust anchors into the system, the priming of the system. I don't want to go into the details because that's not what this presentation is about, but that is something we've been working on. And one of the other things that we've been working on is operational practices. That is a document that really needs review by the people who want to do DNSSEC deployment. This is a document that describes if you want to do key rollover, what are the things you have to think about. If you want to sign your zone, what are the key sizes you can consider. Those kinds of things, operational practices, are documented in this document. And for people who want to do DNSSEC deployment and want to look at it, this might actually be a useful document, and if it's unreadable or not understandable, please contact us. This really needs review in the DNSSOP working group. Anyway, what we also do is try to provide deployment aids. Not much output has been generated, but we've done some work in the background. One of the things that we had with the previous version of DNSSEC was an operational how-to, just sort of, you know, tutorial kind of booklet that says this is the way you deploy this stuff. And we've updated that to be DNSSEC BIS compliant, and it is under final review, but the language essentially is being shaped up. Somebody who actually can write English is going over it and corrects my style and spelling mistakes. And I expect that to be published shortly, within a week or two or so. This will be available on the RIPE DC site, and I will probably send a pointer to the DNS working group list. In looking at deployment inside the RIPE NCC, we figured we needed a key management system to maintain the private keys and to shield them from the net in some sort of prudent way, and to make key management a little bit more easy. That system has been developed. It lives in our labs. And we want to release that, but only after it had some operational stress, so to speak. We want to put this to our operational staff, this system, and see how their experiences are before we release this to the public. But if you are interested in DNSSEC deployment and you're willing to test this kind of software in your lab, send me a mail. I'm happy to ship you the code, and you can try and give me feedback. So this is also a plug for things that are shelved, have been worked on, and are semi-available. We've done DNSSEC training courses. Well, essentially, that is something that has moved out of our tiny little group of three people, but has been maintained by our training team. We have had a couple of events. I see that my slides have not been I've uploaded the wrong slides. We had a couple of events this year already. There are still two more planned for this year. There's one in Amsterdam as October 8th and one in Novosibirsk in the 5th of November. And then there are two courses planned, one each quarter for the next year. And we'll look at that. That planning continues. This is the URL if you want to see where the trainings are held, and if you would like to register for a DNSSEC training. We've also been involved in several groups that look at how DNSSEC can be deployed. Essentially, groups that bring together the actors in the field. There's one group headed by Steve Crocker and Russ Mundy, who have a DNSSEC deployment task force. That's an open group. The URL is www.dnsseqdeployment.org. And essentially, the idea is to develop a roadmap for a global DNSSEC rollout and see how people who are interested in pushing that technology can help. And VeriSign has started the DNSSEC consortium that is more tailored to registries and application developers, and that is something that we that they had a first meeting prior to the ITF 59 in San Diego, and they will have one in Frankfurt, and that's something that we also follow actively. Just to keep the information, to track the information and see where people are going with DNSSEC. The way forward in planning deployment on the reverse tree. I've been standing here many times reporting on DNSSEC and say that we want to deploy this on the reverse tree. But essentially, all the planning, the internal planning for deployment, has been shelved, and we were waiting for ITF completement, the standard. Currently, we are internally planning for DNSSEC deployment on the reverse tree. We're looking at what needs to be done, what the time scales are, on which we can do things. But I don't have hard numbers at the moment. I try to refrain from that joke this time. Most of the tasks that we need to do are well understood, and we're working on them in parallel. Things can be done in parallel, and we will use the DNS working group for proposals and discussions and showing what we intend to do. Essentially, when you deploy DNSSEC, these are the sort of tasks you have to think about. This is the overall task list. I've noted the actors here just to give you an idea. What we need is a private key maintenance policy and the tools. Well, this is an internal NCC thing. If you deploy this in your own organization, this is also something you have to figure out yourself. But it has some community aspects, because the key rollover scenarios that we think of, how we maintain our private keys, has implications for the people who have to maintain trust anchors. So that has some community aspects. The zoning signing and the integration into the provisioning chain is something you have to do when you deploy DNSSEC. That's a purely internal thing. The DNS server infrastructure needs to go needs to be updated to deal with the special processing that DNSSEC needs. So all the authoritative servers that serve your zone files need to be DNSSEC aware, and that is something that is a task for the NCC and its secondaries. So there's some external relationship going on. If you plan to deploy DNSSEC yourself, this is something you should not forget and want to announce early to your secondary friends, your friends that do the secondary serving, because this just takes work, and this takes planning from external parties. And one of the things that is a major chunk of work is actually providing secure delegations, signing the children in the another tree, making sure that that tree gets depth. This has policy aspects and operational aspects. For the policy aspects, we will definitely come back to the working group with proposals or ideas on how to do this. And essentially, that's the status update. As I said, not much happened, but lots of things happen under hood, and the car will start driving soon.
Okay, so just a few words on what's going on with the ISC and in particular with Bind. It will include some words on F-root Anycast, since there were earlier reports on Anycast for the root servers here also, and then some words also on other projects that we have. So just a quick update on the progress of Anycasting F-root around the world. Since last RAP meeting, I reported about the sites. We have added three additional sites. Jakarta, Indonesia, together with APNIC. We keep collaborating with APNIC for deployments in Asia Pacific, and so do other root servers operators, as you have seen already. Deployment in Tel Aviv, that was a region that had nothing in it. And with regards to provision of local root servers, so we went there in collaboration with ISOC Israel and installed at the exchange point. And Munich, we installed at the INXS exchange point. Sorry. There has been a kind of change in the pattern of work involved with this, as Jochen said. Work that takes place every time that's relatively significant in every new installation is setting up the peerings. Every time you go into a new exchange point, you have at least 20 or 30 peers that you need to talk to on a one-to-one basis to set these things up. Thank God we have a fairly simple peering policies, which basically says we won't say anything. If you want to peer, peer. If you don't want to peer, don't peer. It's your choice. So that reduces the cycle of back and forth conversation quite significantly. But we are now at 24 nodes, most of them local nodes by the terminology that's in use. And what we are seeing now, what we expected, but we are definitely seeing it, is a steady increase in the necessary work on maintenance. The first Anycast node we installed was almost 2 years ago. And since then, both Cisco has had several issues with their images they run on the routers. I'm getting some echo, strange here. The operating system has also gone through several updates, so we are now moving from the install, run, and forget about it to let's maintain it, keep it running, look after the peerings, introduce MD5 keys as things happen in the internet, and all this. So it's a bit of a change in the pattern, which we have to adapt to. We are just adapting to. Okay, another project we started just about 1 year ago is the DNS OARC. This is a membership program where people that join get access to infrastructure to deal with basically the problem of communicating in the event of attacks on their DNS infrastructure. It's aimed as being a coordination center, a place where when you are under stress because someone is hitting you for whatever reason, you can turn to find peers you can talk to directly to help you coordinate a response against the attack, and hopefully, in addition to this, analyze, maybe after the attack is over, what went on. Define the pattern of the attack, the origin, try to categorize what happened, etc. So, with regards to providing this infrastructure, we haven't done much during the first year. It has been a bit of a slow start, but we have now got good news. We got applied and got a grant from the National Science Foundation in the US for actually deploying infrastructure and hiring people to do software, to write software to analyze the data that I will be collecting. The idea is that we will initially install data capture machines next to every Fruit Anycast node that will be collecting data in real time and storing it for later analysis, so that we have an idea of what the baseline traffic looks like in quite good detail. And then at the same time, we'll be hiring people to write the software that will allow us to analyze, to break down what is normal traffic and try to alert us from any change in that pattern that might signal probes, like people researching how to best attack your infrastructure, but not yet actually deploying a real attack, just seeing if they find holes on that kind of the pattern that you sometimes you see just before the real thing happens, starts. And of course, we also hope that we'll be able to install this sort of infrastructure and make the software available to all the membership so that they can conduct their own investigations locally, and hopefully, that's the point, join these, join the information they get with the other, with the other membership. Everything is done in a secure way so that people can have confidence in that the information they pass around gets to only to the people they want to get it to, and that other people are not snooping on the thing. In just about a week's time, we'll have the first ORC member meeting. Some people are traveling over there, some others are joining by phone. And basically, the book message here is, this is going to start now, for real, and if you operate any sort of DNS infrastructure, you might want to think about at least investigating what this DNS work is all about, because it can make your life easier. Okay, the Bind Forum. This is something we set up just basically to provide us with a means of financing continued development of Bind. Not adding new features, but just making sure that even if we don't get resources to add new things to Bind, at least there will be someone behind the computer that knows about Bind, that doesn't have to look for a job because we can pay them, and that will fix any bugs, any eventual vulnerabilities that might be discovered, tweak things, basically make sure that Bind is not forgotten and rots in a corner. As I said, that's the objective. We are not yet there, but more people are joining, and again, like the ORC, if you care about Bind, try thinking about joining and helping us out. We had every year we have a member meeting. The last one was at the IDF in San Diego. We try to host them in conjunction with IDFs because a lot of the people who are members happen to be there, so it's easier. It's easier to get everyone together. Don't have to organize extra travel or anything like that. In this meeting, we discussed basically about Bind 9.3, which I'll talk a bit about in a few minutes. But we also discussed about what we are planning to put in Bind 9.4.
and it was quite a good discussion because people were asking for certain features to be put in Bind 9.4, and that the Bind forum members certainly get a bigger saying on what we can put in or not than the general public. Okay, so Bind. In the last few times I've been giving the ISC update, unfortunately I've also always said that Bind 9.3 was just about there. And then months went by and it was still just about there.
6 months?
Well, Pride meetings are every 4 months, but or used to be every 4 months. So what happened? Well, one day what happened was this. We just had, at some point, you just have to stop tweaking it and realize that no piece of software will ever be perfect, and that at some point, either you ship it or you ditch it. So as of 8 in the morning tonight, 3 hours ago, you can download, everyone can download Bind version 9.3.0 and minor updates to the previous versions, 9.2.4 and 8.4.5. This puts an end to a rather long release cycle, since Bind 9.2.0 was released way more than a year ago. There has been a lot of work put into Bind 9.3. Skip this stuff. Big chunks of work were to do with DNSSEC base. This is actually also partly to blame for the delays in Bind. DNSSEC kept being a moving target, and we didn't want to put out a version of Bind that implemented the state of affairs at a given point, because some people might have been seeing that as making the status of DNSSEC at that point a de facto standard, and we definitely did not want that to happen. This is an IDF standard, we are tracking it, but we are not setting it. Unfortunately, if you stay in that mode for long, you get tempted to just tweak this and add that and delete that and do these things differently, and everything just compounds into having a very big release cycle. So there's a lot of work. Even though this is a 9.0 release, so it's the first of the 9.3 family, and we know there are a few bugs there, and we'll be fixing them for 9.3.1, which will be coming out in a couple months, maybe. This is not completely untested software, right? Because since it took us this long to actually come out with the new version, what we have done in the meantime is that as the code was progressing, we were running it on our name servers. Not on FRUIT, but on the main ISC name servers, which host a lot of TLDs and second-level domains for a lot of people. So we are fairly confident that what the code has is working. It has been answering millions upon millions of queries for the best part of 12 months. So most of the new features actually give you more control over what Bind does and how it interacts with your system. It is slightly faster than 9.2, though the big performance improvements we expect to have in 9.4. If we can get enough people to support that work. But it controls memory. It also implements the current status of the server ID draft. It's a bit stalled, but people were asking for it, so we just put it there. It's not significant. And then a lot of other things. You can go download the package and look at the changes file to find out what's new. It's a very long list, and I already presented an overview of that list in previous occasions. There is also a defects list, things that we know that are not working as they should, but that are not significant enough to prevent us from releasing, so that you know if something in the defects list actually affects you. Well, you can wait, or you can provide us with a patch if you feel like it. But basically, that's what we know about the code right now. And that's what we have been up to recently. If there are any questions.
Thank you, Joao. Any questions? Oh, come on. Can can you say anything about anti-spam or something to just wake up the people? Who's your, what's your name and use the mic?
This is Mr. Manning, and this is just a, I guess a specious question, which is, when is 931 coming out?
931 will come out when we are certain that people have not found anything major. Basically, that all the bugs we know about are the ones that are there. If people, I mean, we want to give it some testing time out in the field, because as I said, we have been running this code for almost a year, but we run a particular setup, which I think is a fairly usual setup, but then people start doing weird things out there, and there are conditions that you just simply cannot reproduce or haven't thought about, so we just want to have a bit of time. There might be intermediate patches. There might be small patches that won't increment the version to particular pieces of code. We're currently discussing that.
Understood. Thank you.
Anyone else?
No.
If you don't mind. It's not only that 930 came out, but also 925, I guess.
924.
Four, sorry. Can you give a rule of thumb the migration path for anyone who is currently running 923 or 92 something?
I think this one summarizes that.
Oh, okay.
We basically have called 92X end of life, and this 924 should be the last release of 92, the 92 family. Work is now happening in the 93, and we will give people 6 months, which is, I think, is ample time to consider whether it's worthwhile for them to migrate or not. And then it will take longer to get answers to your questions on bind 92, if you get them.
Okay, that means 925 is something like a courtesy issue? Or?
Well, yeah, because there was a lot of time, and there was a, between the last release and this one, there were bugs that were present in code that was not the new code in 9.3 that we know that were there. So bind 9.3 and bind 9.2 do share common code, right? It's not a complete rewrite. So we didn't feel that we could just release 9.3 and tell people, well, you have to upgrade. Particularly, even though we have tested 9.3, it's a .0 release, and some people just have strange feelings about that kind of numbering. So, okay, we'll put out a release that fixes all the bugs we know that were in the 9.2 family,
mm-hmm.
and call it the end of the final one.
Okay. Another question, unless anyone else wants... Yep.
Just out of curiosity, I mean, bind 8 is end of line and
mm-hmm.
life. I'm hearing that for the last
and
two
it
years.
Is. We haven't added anything to bind 8 for a long time. The only thing that has been done with bind 8 have been bug fixes. When will we stop doing bind fixes? This is the question of being a responsible citizen. Bind 8 is significantly different from bind 9. Bind 9 is actually much better than bind 8. For instance, bind 9 has never had a security vulnerability reported, whereas bind 8, you can compound a database about that stuff. So there is all sorts of arguments why you should move from bind 8 to bind 9, but bind 8 had some special interpretation of the standards, which over time we have realized might not be accurate. So bind 9 in that sense is much more standards conformant, or what we think the standards say, than bind 8. Unfortunately, some people have decided that these bugs were actually features and have based part of the services they deliver on these missed features. So it's hard to get them to realize that what they are doing with their DNS is wrong, it's not standards compliant, and that they should move, because the amount of work it means for them is quite significant. Also, some OS vendors were for one reason or another wary of shipping bind 9, because there was this myth, or there is this myth, that bind 9's performance is much lower than bind 8's performance. It's a reality and it's myth. It depends on what you are measuring and what the traffic pattern to your server is running. If you're running bind 8 on a root server, it is faster than bind 9. If you are running bind 9 on some TLDs, you load some of the TLDs and rerun TCP dump traces against this server, bind 9 is faster than bind 8 in some of the TLDs. Okay? And this simply has to do with the different patterns. 98% of the queries that the root servers get are for things that do not exist. Okay? It's questions sort of like localhost, my workgroup, this sort of rubbish that just escapes, and since there is no TLD for it, it ends up at the root servers, right? Whereas TLDs actually tend to get a different pattern of questions. They tend to be asked for domains that actually exist, much more than the root servers. So this is such a different pattern of querying that the profile of performance is significantly different, and bind 9 is actually faster for some of these. Okay? For some applications, it's slower. In any case, the number of people that need the kind of performance that bind 9 is capable of delivering in even old PC hardware is not that significant. I mean, in any off-the-shelf PC, bind 9 is capable of doing 3,000 or 4,000 queries per second. And normally you don't have one server per zone, you have more than one. So, I mean, be realistic.
Jerry, DNS Mode again. Another question about bind 9 is that when it was initially released, the plans were that it would be a threaded server,
yeah,
and you have the ability to load zones and serve queries at the same time.
Yes.
Will that be a 9.3, or will it be a 9.3 dot something or other, or what?
Bind 9.3 does this better than bind 9.2 did. So it handles memory better, so it's capable of not saturating the system completely while it's loading a zone, and actually be able to serve the data that still has loaded from the old zone while it's loading the new one. It still takes a performance hit because it's doing more work at the same time. We do have a problem with bind 9's design in the threaded model, to be honest with you. There was so much care put into making the code in bind 9 safe that the designers just went a little bit over the top on the amount of locking and unlocking that was going on the threads. So what happens? What happens is that currently, as you increase the number of processors, bind 9 runs slower, because it enters in contention. The different threads compete for the same resources, and there is so much locking and unlocking going on that they end up running slower than they do in a uniprocessor machine. And that's something we are working in, but, well, it's not trivial.
Question relayed from outside. How about bind 9 performance for ISP servers with lots of small zones? And I guess the locking and so forth would come into play there.
Locking only comes into play when you really have a lot of threads doing the same type of work. Okay, otherwise you just have different databases loaded into memory, and there's no contention for them, unless you are there are dynamic update zones which can be changed at the same time querying, in which case there is no way around taking a performance hit. We don't see major performance problems there. But if the person that's saying this can provide with some more information, that would be nice, so that we can put this into the lab and try to see what they are seeing, basically. We have this lab that can reproduce quite a lot of setups.
Yeah, by the way, if I may, the survey I presented, I guess, last RAV meeting supported exactly that question.
Mm-hmm.
If you remember, the bind 9 was, if you just counted the number of servers, was in the lead, whereas if you took into account the number of zones served, mm-hmm, bind 8 still won. And I would be very interested to do that survey again in, say, 6 months' time, or for the next write meeting and see how that changed. And
it would be interesting, definitely.
Yeah.
Hi, Joao. I'm Roy Arends from Telematica Institute. I have a question regarding the races project you guys doing. IC is doing with Lechnik.
Can
you report on that a little bit?
Okay, this is the first part of the F-Route Anycasting project that we have, and in trying to bring F-Route to places where the route servers are not present or are just far away, we talked to Lechnik to get to see if we could collaborate with them on deploying Anycast nodes in Latin America in their service region. And they were interested, and so we reached an agreement, and the idea is that we'll together be deploying 5, 6, 7 Anycast nodes in Latin America. So from Mexico, including the Caribbean, except the U.S., whatever you call them, territories, and all of South America. So.
And the one in Brazil, is it part of the... Or was it already before the race agreement?
Brazil and Mexico are both nodes active already, and it's before. Those two countries had the resources to sponsor us directly to go there, and they also had the huge amounts of internal traffic. In deploying Anycast mirrors, it's interesting that... some people talk about finding the best connected points, the points in the internet where most traffic converges. But sometimes the reality is that the internet is not as uniform. It's not like it reaches everyone everywhere in equal conditions, and therefore there are the points where more roads cross, that's the points that where most traffic finds. There are sort of islands. We see this, for instance, in Korea and Brazil as very clear examples. They are countries which currently have traffic patterns that make the traffic stay mostly inside their own countries, both because they have local content in their own languages, and people tend to look for that more than content in English. So, for instance, in Brazil, I think we get almost about 25% of the traffic we get in a global node. Because in this particular case, the lines that they have for external connectivity all go to the U.S. They are getting bigger, but then they're not huge yet. But their internal deployment inside the country is quite good, and there is a lot of people in that country. So there is a lot of traffic that just stays local.
I just want to congratulate you and ISC with the effort, because I travel through South America a lot, and I see the local infrastructure getting better and better and better every year.
Yeah.
And it's good to see some of this effort going there. So thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
Okay, any further questions? Thank you, Laura.
You're welcome.
And Jim, it's your turn.
Okay, we're running a little bit late, so I'll try to make this as short as possible. All I want to do is give you an update on what's been happening in DNS Moda since we spoke about it at the last Right meeting in Stockholm, and give you an idea of where things are headed. A few small things have happened. We have a logo, and we have a website. This is the first time I've ever written any HTML, and I find it exceedingly difficult. So my apologies that the website doesn't have nice flashy graphics and style sheets and all the rest of that stuff. I'm having enough trouble trying to get Dreamweaver to do what I want it to do, and I just don't get WYSIWYG. But we'll get this improved over time. We've had a fairly successful outreach activity. We got very valuable feedback from the Centre General Assembly in Stockholm back in June, and a fairly surprisingly positive response at the ITF meeting in San Diego, and I'll tell you a little bit about that too. An advisory panel is established, and MODA's first work items are already underway.
So I was lucky to get an invite to go along and talk to the Central General Assembly and was able to, if you like, do a sales pitch for MODAR to the GTLDs or CCTLD constituencies in Europe. We got a lot of valuable information and feedback on the funding model that we proposed and governance issues. And it was a good understanding there of where CCTLD managers perceive this thing and what they thought the potential benefits are and what would they get from MODAR in exchange for money. So that was a very valuable exercise for myself, and a couple of TLDs said to us at the time that they were supportive of MODAR in principle and would be looking very closely at membership, and some of them are fairly close to joining as I speak. Oh, wrong way. San Diego was a bit of a surprise. We booked a room in the Hilton Hotel, which was about a 50-minute walk away from the Sheraton where the actual meeting was in place. And beforehand, we expected we'd maybe get about 20, 25 people to turn up, and we booked a room big enough for a little bit more than that. Turns out we had more than 70 people there. 70 people actually signed the sheet, and I know there were people that didn't sign it. So I think maybe we were close towards 80. There was standing room only there. Again, we got very strong feedback of the proposed fee structure, and the suggestions we had there at the time were fairly strongly rejected. Some people voiced those concerns publicly, some other people took us to task in private after the actual meeting itself. So we had some things to think about that inside MODAR, and we have revised our fee structure as a result of it. There was also one or two people who expressed concerns, quite reasonable concerns, I suppose, in a sense that MODAR might be fragmenting the ITF standards efforts, and I think we've been asked to clarify those misunderstandings, because MODAR is definitely not about that. So the idea is that we produce drafts, and those drafts will go to the ITF in the same way as everybody else's. There will be other things that MODAR does that may not fit into the ITF model, such as working APIs, and if ITF wants to look at that stuff, fine. But the chances are we'll probably take API type activity and take it to IEEE or POSIX or something like that, because they may be more interested in that kind of standardisation effort. So, the revised fee structure. We've simplified things and clarified it. We've now said that there's a voluntary fee structure for everybody. We've got rid of the idea of having a percentage fee structure or a tiered structure based on turnover for commercial organisations. So we're saying the bands are now, or the membership levels are $1,000, $5,000, $10,000, $25,000 and $50,000 a year. And the minimum entry point for a non-profit organisation would be $10,000 a year. And for a member contributing at the gold or silver levels, that's $50,000 or $25,000, they would be guaranteed a place on the MODAR Architecture Board. And if those of you can remember from the presentation last time, the Architecture Board decides what the work plan is of MODAR and its priorities and does the resource allocation. And that's been a fairly powerful message that a lot of companies have appreciated. They feel that then by contributing at that kind of level, they have a degree of control and influence over what things happen inside MODAR itself. And that's been a very powerful incentive for organisations to consider joining. Membership news. Well, we haven't got anybody signed on the dotted line yet, and money has changed hands other than the initial founding members. But we've had delays caused by the summer holidays, so things are now just starting to crank up after that. So a number of companies, a number of TLD registries are now looking very closely at the MODAR documents, the membership agreements, and they're doing the due diligence as I speak. So we're having some discussions around issues relating to things like intellectual property rights and what about the fact that MODAR doesn't have any legal status at the moment? How do we see that unfolding over the future? So things are beginning to come together there, and I expect we're going to see some members on board fairly soon, within the next month or so. And some of those are household names. I can't tell you who they are right now for obvious reasons, but things are beginning to come together there quite well. We've also got work items underway. The WIND project has given a fairly substantial project allocation to MODAR to do work on the area of producing some documents in the area of a DNS conformance test suite, and also to do some lecture materials for the School of the Internet. and we should start to see concrete results come out of that particular project activity towards the end of the year. I think we might see a sort of staged approach with things, something coming out, say, towards the end of October, and then fairly sort of monthly milestones after that. So this will also be another, I think, very powerful incentive for people to join, because they can see that MODA's not some kind of talking shop that's just going to yak and yak and yak. There will be concrete, useful, practical results coming out of that, which everybody can benefit from, and that should give everyone a reasonable degree of confidence that their money is going to be used in a wise and sensible manner. That's all I have to say, so I'll take some questions if anybody has any at this point. Okay. Peter?
Thanks, Jim. Okay, now it's time for all brave geeks to come to the help of the working group, because we're kind of walking through the open action items. If I manage to get to the website. Hopefully you all have realized that the action items which have grown out of the latest RIPE meeting in Amsterdam are placed on the web page, and they are linked from our working group's homepage. So there are four of them at the moment, and we plan to continue this and then tick off the done action items and fill in new ones as they come up. Okay, so four of them there are, and funny enough, the first one was on me. That's a quick one. I don't have any slides prepared, and apologies for that. I was to collect experiences with lameness problems at large ISPs when, say, customer zones or customer name servers get lame on the customer zones. I have done some research contacting in a local news group, contacting ISPs, and have received some feedback, and I'm in the process of writing that down, sending it to the mailing list, and during the next RIPE meeting, there will definitely be a draft. It will be there in advance so that we can talk about that part, meaning that this action item is a work in progress. Second one, Mons Nielsen couldn't probably make it here. No? He isn't in the room. No, he couldn't make it. Okay. Feedback from him is that he studied some work but needs a bit more time. He was shifted away from that by his day duties. So it's also work in progress, but he's definitely doing something on this and will probably be able to present that either on the mailing list to the working group or during the next RIPE meeting, which is probably very close to his own premises. Third one, Olaf.
The action point was to send a pointer to the current list of checks. September 9, I've posted a message to the DNS working group list that says that if you go to the reverse how-to pages, that's www.ripe.net/reverse, and you go to the how-to, there is a link to the web delegation checker, and from the web delegation checker there is a link to an explanation of the problem codes that are returned. Now, that are essentially the problem codes that we also return for our checks in when you send updates for reverse delegations, except that the library we currently use in our RUS database is an updated version of the library that is used on the web page. So the tests are slightly different, although the overall ideas are still maintained. So as an input for discussion about which kind of tests need to be done or what kind of updates we need, we think that this list, which is on the web, and that whole chain of links is available from the mail, is sufficient. What we are doing currently is looking at those tests, and we are trying, we have on our list of things to do, to update the web delegation checker to use the same library, and also to give the similar error message as the WHIS database provides back, and give a little bit more of documentation on that. But if the working group wants to look at the tests that are done and wants to give feedback on additional tests that the working group would like to get done, then please follow those links and respond.
Okay, thanks, Olaf. And yes, I would suggest that we set a timeline of, say, 6 weeks in this case. We'll be sending out another call for proposals to the mailing list with a timeline of 6 weeks, and if there's no response and no further interest, we will close down this action item, but still it can be reopened any time in the future if the need arises. Is that fine with all of you? Anyone still with me? Okay, nodding heads. Great. Okay, thanks, Olaf. Next is David Malone, who is in here. And who has brought his own slides with him. Pardon me? I am Windows impaired.
Okay, so on the last Write meeting I gave a short presentation about problems that people encounter when they go to a web page and something issues a request for a quad A record and the name server at the other end has some kind of issue. What the name server should say if the domain actually exists is that there are zero records of that type or there are three records of that type, and here they are. This draft mentioned here describes the protocol side of the problem. It usually either manifests itself as a web page that takes ages to come up, or a web page that just isn't available at all. It's rather tricky to diagnose, so if anybody wants to try and see if a domain has this problem, this URL here has a script that will do it for you. So since the last Write meeting, we've written a short document describing not the protocol side of the problem, but how it appears to an end user and what a DNS operator might want to do about it. We were trying to figure out what to do next about it. The best suggestion that we have is that we publish a good document on it so people can reference it. I was also bringing up the possibility of maybe we go and nag the people who have this problem. And we've decided that seems to be a bad idea. There isn't a lot of support for that. Some other issues are brought up, say, either with client resolver libraries that have problems doing quad A lookups. And there's a question about whether they should be included in this document or a separate document, or what should be done about that. So perhaps one other question is, are things getting better or worse at the moment? So these are figures for January this year, April, and August. And the way these were compiled was to take a list of host names from proxy logs and see how many had the problem. So things are actually getting better. We have slightly more quad A records than we had before, and the percentage of name servers that have issues is actually going down. So maybe by the next Write meeting they'll all be gone, if we keep our fingers crossed. DoubleClick are still the main people that you trip across that have the problem, but HP's shopping website and some other people like that have the problem too. This is the results by name server rather than by name. People can stare at them if they want, but the slides will be available if anybody wants to digest the figures in detail. So that's all I have to say. I guess if anybody would like to suggest either changes to the document or if other topics should be included in the document, maybe they should do that on the list.
Yeah, thanks, David. Any comments, remarks?
Hi, Roy Adams, Telematic Institute. I was just curious, how did you go on and identify different implementations?
So the only effort that I've made to identify what I'm picking out here is either a name or an IP address of a name server that has a problem. I did try using the FPDNS work that was presented a couple of years ago on it.
I've heard of it, yeah.
So it identified some servers fairly definitively, and then it had a long list of very obscure sort of return codes that had been produced that weren't definitively identified. And I keep meaning to track down... Are the FPDNS people here?
Yes, they're here.
That's wonderful. Okay, I'd like to talk to you then, because you may be able to help me get better results.
Okay, I'll be here all day.
Great.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks. So the way we proceed with this, I guess you, David, are willing to do another survey in 5 months, say, in advance of the next RIDE meeting, so we can see whether it's really a vanishing problem, and then decide to probably turn down this action item and declare it closed. That's it? Any objections? Anything else? Okay. So, since we still have 5 minutes left, I want to keep you in the room and just like to find my way through Windows. No, just kidding. When I mentioned this website, I would just like to encourage people, especially people probably new to this working group. To have a look at the homepage of the working group, the RIDE DNS working group website. You'll not only find our charter there, but oh, that's great. Thank you. You also find the minutes. The minutes we approved yesterday, which are there as draft minutes and will be updated soon, I guess. The open action items list, all the previous meeting minutes, links to the presentations, and more importantly, you will find the link to the archive of the mailing list and instructions how to subscribe to the mailing list, just in case you're interested and you're not already on. So any reference to text and discussion that has gone to the mailing list is not being hidden from you. You can just access it through the archive. Okay. So, Ben, I'd like to thank you for being here for this morning. The working group will continue at, at 11. We go to the coffee break. See you in half an hour. Thank you.